Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I feel like my voice is a little smoother.
Well, you know? That makes sense because we have officially upgraded your microphone. Thank God. It's taken long enough.
Yeah, it was time.
Yeah, because I upgraded my microphone a little while ago and Alex was still using his old microphone and I would legitimately have to spend probably an extra hour editing our episode, like just to adjust his volume level because the microphone was not as good. Anyway, I don't know if anyone cares about that, but I sure do.
Yeah, I think it sounds better.
It sounds way better, I'm sure.
Yeah. But yeah, it's fun. A little new tech. I don't know really how to operate it yet, but we will figure it out.
Well, you just speak into it and it'll do its job.
Can you speak?
You know how to talk?
I have practice.
Good. Very good. Well, today we're talking about a cult.
Okay.
A really famous cult that I do really nothing about until the past 48 hours, and I have shoved so much information into my brain that now I fear I know too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't every episode kind of like that?
Well, yeah, but this episode in particular, I have just about 20 pages of single-spaced, 11-size type font of notes.
So wow, it came with the citations, I'm sure.
Yeah, MLA format. Thank you. Yep, very good.
Lovely.
Yeah, so I've got a lot of information to give you. And on that note, why don't we just jump in?
Yeah, let's waste no time.
Okay. Do you know anything about Heaven's Gate?
No, I know nothing.
Okay.
But apparently they're a cult.
Yeah, so they're not too dissimilar from like Jim Jones or Waco in that the members will commit suicide. So I just want to give, a quick trigger warning right there. There will be discussion about suicide, but that's way later in the episode. So we've got plenty of information before that.
I thought you were going to say we have plenty of time to work up to that.
Well, no, I mean, kind of, but, you know. But just so you know what we're getting into, I wanted to let you know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Our listeners will have, you know, the episode description, but you don't, so...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's not many of these out there.
There aren't that many, no. I mean, it's one of the most famous cults of all time, I'd say.
Yeah, God, I mean, just again, like every time with a cult, it's just how do you get there, but...
Well, this one is even, I don't know, their beliefs get pretty wacky.
Okay,
well... Yeah, let's jump in.
Hit me with it.
Heaven's Gate Cult was founded by Marshall Herf Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles, who would later become known as T and Doe. Herf was Doe and Bonnie was T. Marshall Herf Applewhite was born in Spur, Texas on May 17, 1931. He had three siblings and was the son of a Presbyterian minister, Marshall Herf Sr., and he was very religious as a child. For the first few decades of his life, Herf Applewhite strove to make his father proud and wanted to follow a similar path as him, but a number of things would make that very difficult for him, including his confused sexuality, or rather his homosexuality. As a young adult, he got his bachelor's degree in philosophy at Austin College and then went on to Union Presbyterian Seminary to become a minister, like his father. He married a woman named Anne Pierce and had two children with her. Shortly after getting to University of Alabama to teach, Herf found himself in a scandal with a male graduate student, and he was fired, allegedly because of their relationship. And in 1968, 3 years after finding out about their affair, his wife ended up divorcing him. When Applewhite revealed to his parents that he was homosexual, his father rejected him, and this kind of started the spiral out of control for Herf Applewhite. And after that, he moved from Alabama to Houston to teach at University of St. Thomas. He was liked by his students and everyone around him. He was an engaging speaker and a stylish dresser and had an amazing voice. Are you grinning because he's gay and he has good style?
Yeah, but like I wasn't going to say anything because it's too easy.
Well, I mean, he had good style and I wonder why.
It's like, no shit, he's got good style.
Yeah, the gays know how to dress. So,
generally, yes.
I think so. On top of teaching, Herf was attempting a career in opera. He had gotten his biggest role yet at Houston Grand Opera. He was cast as Olin Blitch in the opera Susanna, who was a traveling preacher who seduces the character Susanna. But during rehearsals, he had some kind of psychotic episode and had to be hospitalized. It was also around that time that he had resigned from University of St. Thomas, which is believed to also have been prompted by another affair with another male student. And while Herf was in the hospital, he met nurse Bonnie Lou Nettles, or T.
How did he get in the hospital?
He had a psychotic break.
Oh.
Or a psychotic episode while he was in that opera.
Like on stage?
During rehearsals, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So while Herf was in the hospital, like I said, he met Bonnie Lou Nettles, a.k.a. T. The story would later be that he met T at a hospital while visiting a sick friend, and she was a nurse, but he was in fact the sick friend. Bonnie Nettles was born in Houston, Texas, to a Baptist family in 1927. She married a successful businessman who fought in World War II, and they had three children together. Their marriage, based off of what I could find about it, was fine until Bonnie became obsessed with contacting the dead in 1972.
Okay.
Of all the things to make your marriage fall apart.
She's like, yeah, one day she wanted to talk to the dead.
You know, she just wanted to talk to dead people. We can't all be Teresa Caputo.
No,
what can I say?
No, we can't.
Yeah, so she met Doe that year when he was in a very vulnerable state, and she convinced him that he was her soulmate. She told Doe that she was an astrologer and could read his star chart. And from that, she said that they were fated to work together on some grand project, and they were destined to become spiritual partners. Perfect thing to say to someone having a psychotic episode. So from there, they began living together. But they were never romantically involved. They were spiritual partners, but platonically. Bonnie had been married with multiple kids, like I said, so when she left to live with Herf, her marriage, of course, ended, and most of her kids disowned her, except one of her daughters named Terry. Before she met Murph Applewhite, she was already very into New Age thinking, like crystals and seances and ascended beings and UFOs. And she and her daughter Terry would talk about UFOs and how cool it would be if one would come down and take them away. They would speculate about what it would be like to go to a different planet because they both wanted to leave Earth.
How bad is it for them regularly that this is what they're obsessed with?
I mean, I don't know.
I guess we'll never know, but you know what I mean? It's just you're obsessed with leaving this Earth.
Yeah, that's a little bit of...
Right? I mean, things can't be great.
No. I guess they were just interested in aliens.
Sure.
So many people looked at Doe as the leader, but T really kind of recruited Doe. He was her follower, almost. I mean, they were the two leaders of Heaven's Gate, but in a sense, T was kind of the top dog.
Okay, interesting.
Bonnie and Herf traveled around the country on their self-exploration journey and visited other New Age thinkers, gurus, and alternative health centers. They were just trying to find some like-minded individuals that were down for aliens. They had no money, so they stayed in churches and took odd jobs along the way. At some point, they were so poor, they were selling their blood and surviving on dinner rolls. So, there's that. Shortly after, in 1973, they ended up on the Oregon coast, and it occurred to them that they had finally figured out the answers. By 1974, they had published a pamphlet, and that pamphlet suggested Jesus would come back as a Texan man, and Bonnie and Murph were the two witnesses that are described in Revelation chapter 11. They were destined to be martyred and then rise from the dead. And a quote from that Revelation chapter said, "And after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and they ascended up into heaven in a cloud." They said that the book of Revelation refers to people ascending to heaven in a cloud, but that was just because they didn't know about aliens at that time. So really, they would be ascending to heaven in a flying saucer.
Word. Okay. Also, this is translated like three times or something like that?
Yeah, it's got to be a bunch.
So I really wonder what the original true meaning was.
No idea. But to them, it was aliens. They said, you're going to get on a flying saucer and you're going to go to heaven that way.
Okay.
Okay. So it wasn't just a spiritual message, but a scientific and technological one. And part of their teaching was, with a powerful enough telescope, you could see God. Which is just a fun thing to think about, I guess. But still, kind
of... still working on it.
Kind of kooky, yeah. Yeah. They determined that people who accept their message can follow them into outer space, into the kingdom of God, aka the next level. That's what they call it. And they referred to that as the demonstration, which was essentially the end of the world. This is just a funny side note, but in 1974, Murph was arrested after failing to return a rental car, and his defense was God gave him permission to use the car. That made me laugh.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
He said, well, God said I could have it, so I took it. Like, what?
Okay, buddy.
So once they had these grand revelations, they began traveling around the country to recruit members, targeting college campuses and other New Age thinkers. Classic cult work. September 14th, 1975, T and Doe held a meeting in Waldport, Oregon, which is near Newport, Oregon, if you're familiar. This mysterious couple appeared in town circulating a flyer claiming a UFO would be coming soon to take whoever wanted to follow them to another life and another world. They held meetings at motels and any other space they could really find. And from that meeting, there were 34 people who ended up joining that day. And among them was a man named Sawyer. He saw the flyer after leaving a band practice and was immediately intrigued. These flyers said, UFOs, why are they here? Who have they come for? When will they leave? Two individuals say they are about to leave the next human level and literally, in parentheses, physically enter the next evolutionary level in a spacecraft UFO within months. Followers of, quote-unquote, the two will discuss how the transition from the human level to the next level is accomplished and when this may be done. This is not a religious or philosophical organization recruiting membership. However, the information has already prompted a number of individuals to devote their total energy to the transitional process. If you have ever entertained the idea that there might be a real physical level in space beyond the Earth's confines, you will want to attend this meeting.
I'm in.
And so were a lot of other people.
Yeah. I would like to just go to see what's going on.
So that also happened for people who like weren't necessarily bought into the whole idea of aliens, but they were like, we're just going to go see what the hell's up.
Dude, what? Yeah, I agreed that. I'm like, what the hell is going on there?
Right. So this flyer also intrigued Frank Lyford. At the time, Frank had been dating a woman named Erica Ernst for about 3 years, and they were taking a vacation to Oregon to visit Frank's cousin, David Van Sinderden.
What?
That is a silly last name. I just read it and said it, and then I was like, did I say that right? I think I did.
Okay. I totally thought that you messed up.
Sinderden. Oh, it was Sinderden, not Sinderden.
Okay.
Anyway, all three of them drove out to Waldport to attend this meeting, and the place was packed. There were close to 200 people in that room. T and Doe, or quote-unquote the two, came out onto the stage and sat there for a minute or two without saying anything.
To a sold-out crowd.
Yeah, 200 people, literally. When they did finally speak, they said they were there to teach people the process of how to get to the next physical level. They would chemically change kind of how a caterpillar turns into a chrysalis and then becomes a butterfly. If people followed their approach, your body would chemically and biologically transform into a perfected alien, and you would physically board a UFO to travel to the next level or heaven. The people in this crowd said that they felt euphoric, almost high. They were mesmerized by T and Doe. Sawyer said that while he was watching them on stage, he felt like he saw this like electric haze above them, and when he looked around the crowd, it was also on everyone else, which led him to believe that that was the Holy Spirit. He was only 24 at the time and didn't have a ton of concrete beliefs, but he believed everything T and Doe were saying. The crowd felt like they were sitting in front of the equivalent of Jesus. They asked the crowd to leave behind all of their possessions and come with them to start their repair. And 34 of them did. The area of Waldport, after they had this meeting, had 20 people who were reported missing because they just up and left and followed T and Doe.
Wait, so they just left their jobs and families behind?
Yes.
That's insane. They had a 17% conversion rate.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And 20 people were reported missing.
See, but this is what I mean, where I want to be there. I want to see what made people leave their whole lives.
Yeah.
You know?
There were plenty of those who just like up and left. Like there were a couple people who just up and left their kids.
I mean, nothing could make me do that.
Well,
I mean,
no, but...
What would actually think? Like, would there be anything that would make you do this?
No. I mean, okay. I can sit here and say that, but also like most of the members were incredibly smart, like well-off, well-adjusted. Well, I guess I can't really say well-adjusted, but they were... like smart people. Like there were doctors and accountants and lawyers and artists, and like they were not a bunch of loons, you know?
Interesting. It sounds similar to the cult in South Korea.
Yes. Yeah. That well, that's
recruited
like college students,
honor students.
Yes. Like the top of the top of college students. Yeah. I mean, that's like a very typical cult thing to do because they want high functioning people to run their cult in a high-functioning way, you know?
Yeah. And it, like, gives it legitimacy, too.
Absolutely.
Wild. Okay, continue.
Yeah, it's like you just have to be just vulnerable enough, you know? I feel like falling into a cult is a little too easy.
Yeah. Life's got to be pretty not good.
Yes, well, that too. They also had a very good sales tactic. Doe wouldn't answer people's questions. They wouldn't do a Q&A session during their events. Instead, they would take people's names, phone numbers, and sometimes addresses, and they would contact them.
So this was the original, like, put in your email to sign up?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so
they're not dumb.
No, they're not. And so they would contact you. And that also, like, was a good process for them because it would weed out the people who weren't actually interested.
Yeah, it's true.
They then would use very scientific terms to talk about these very unscientific things, but it sounded really good. They also stressed the time frame of all of this happening. Like, the spaceship was coming, and you had to be with them to catch the ride. People really bought into it. The group that left was told to bring any camping gear they had, and they would all travel to a campsite in Boulder, Colorado, where they would all be split up into smaller groups. It was the 70s. It was the time of hippies and beatniks, and people were searching for different types of religions where they could fit in or become enlightened. Sawyer said he was searching for something, but he just wasn't sure what. He said in high school he had started experimenting with weed and LSD and had gotten into spirituality, and he was trying out different spiritual groups. He wanted to be enlightened like so many people claimed they were. Many of the people who were in Heaven's Gate had already tried other religious options and were struggling to figure out the right fit for them. Heaven's Gate is a Christian offshoot, and it was a time of great societal stress, and also many religious groups thought that the world was going to end. It was also the first time that people started believing in UFOs and flying saucers. One of the best-selling books at the time was Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Däniken. That's
Van Däniken.
How I'm going to say it. He claimed he had evidence that the world's ancient religions were founded by extraterrestrials, which is why when people encountered Heaven's Gate in the 70s, they didn't say that this was the craziest thing they'd ever heard. They felt like it was exactly what they were looking for.
Wow, so that book kind of paved the way?
Well, the book and also the fact that people were just then starting to believe in UFOs. It was just around the same time as, like, that story we told of the most famous alien abduction. Betty and Bob?
No.
What is
something else.
It was
definitely Betty.
Definitely Betty. The Hills. Hill abduction. Yeah. Betty Hill. Anyway, doesn't matter. This was the time of, like, UFOs, is my point.
Cool.
Heaven's Gate told them that the world was on the brink of being recycled, and their only chance to survive was to leave Earth with them. So people accepted that the two were space aliens who were going to help them get to heaven. T and Doe went by many names. They called themselves the two, mostly. But for a while, they started calling themselves Bo and Peep, because now they had sheep. And that's not even a lie.
I wish they would have stayed Bo and Peep. That's a better name.
Well, they eventually went back to Doe and T. And their followers didn't know where that name T and Doe came from, but they found out later on that it was the Sound of Music, which was T's favorite musical. And both Doe and T were musical theater fans. And their followers watched The Sound of Music many times. Because, you know, like, Doe, a deer, a female deer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking, what is it, the scales that you...
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. There's a song in Sound of Music where they sing the solfege scale. And do and ti, you know, that will bring us back to do.
Sure.
You know, whatever. Anyway.
I haven't seen it, so...
You haven't seen it? Okay, never mind. It came from the musical.
Are you surprised?
No, I'm not. I'm just a little disappointed. So... While personal choice was encouraged in their doctrine, they were very authoritarian with their followers. They pressured the members further and further into their devotion and to look at Doe not just as their leader, but as their father figure and their guide. They shouldn't try to resolve anything on their own. They should bring all of their issues to him and he would help them through it. They hit the road again and started staying in their isolated campgrounds and encouraged their followers to cut all ties with their families and friends and to get rid of any of their worldly possessions. When the story broke that 20 people had gone missing on the Oregon coast after attending a meeting about UFOs, sociologist Robert Balk was interested, to say the least. In 1975, he had gone to Sedona, Arizona to do research on this emerging New Age community, but as he walked down the sidewalk, he came across a Heaven's Gate poster, and he wondered if those people who he had been reading about in the news were there, so he decided to attend the meeting. And he went into the meeting, and it was so weird. Doe and T were not there, but there were members who were spreading their message, and from that meeting, 9 people decided to join. Which was bizarre to Robert, so he decided to go undercover to see what was going to happen.
I love this storyline, because I don't have the balls to do this, right. But this is a fantasy I would have.
Absolutely. That night he went home and he called his friend, David Taylor, who was also a sociologist, and asked if he wanted to do this with him. David was kind of a hippy-dippy graduate student, and Robert knew he was the only one of his classmates who would drop everything to do this with him.
So in a weird way, they're also leaving their entire lives behind to go undercover?
Well, yes, but they know they're doing it as undercover, whatever.
But it's a bit.
But yes, they are leaving their families behind, and they're going to go into it.
Wow.
So these members who had been at the meeting were on their way back to meet up with the two, who they hadn't seen in a few weeks. So Robert and David asked if they could come with the members, but they told Robert that they didn't know where they were going yet, so if he wanted to join them, he'd have to go to a town outside of Oakland, California, go to the post office, and once they knew where he should go, they would leave him an address on page 100 of the zip code book.
Wow, this is really how people operated back then.
Well, that and they were also very secretive. Like, they were not just trying to take any rando off the street, apparently, even though they're a cult.
Okay. Interesting. Also, they're holding meetings?
Yeah. So I guess they didn't want scrutiny from the media or police. So they were, like, really trying to make people jump through hoops to, like, join the group a little bit. So they did that. Meaning Robert and David, went to this post office and checked page 100, and there was no address, but it just said, meet us at the top of Mount Diablo. So wow. They hitched a ride to the top of this mountain, but when they got there, all they could find were some books in a trash can from Heaven's Gate and like flyers. So they thought that they had just missed them. And they were like, oh my God, if we went to the top of this mountain to get to these people and we just missed them, that would be terrible. But just then, 2 cars full of members pull up and tell them to get in. And then they were off. Throughout his time with the group, Robert kept notes. The name of their process was human individual metamorphosis. And since it was such an individual process, nobody felt like they had any authority over anyone else. They were all focused on their own overcoming. Doe taught that they couldn't reach the kingdom of heaven as long as they still had addictions and attachments to the human kingdom, whether it be people, things, careers, anything. Many of the members had children, like I said, but they had to make a choice. Did they want to prove their loyalty to God and go to the kingdom of heaven, or did they want to be with their children? And many of them chose Heaven's Gate.
God, I can't imagine. Can you imagine being one of the kids?
No.
Like, so, yeah, mom just left?
Mom and dad.
Oh, both of them.
Yeah. Well, so there was two members. I believe their names were Suzanne and I want to say Wayne Cook. Anyway, they were a married couple who had a 9-year-old kid, and they came back home and they told their kid, hey, we just went to this meeting and it's aliens and they're going to come pick us up in a spaceship. And the 9-year-old said, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. What are you talking about? That's crazy. And they said, see you later. And they left her with the grandparents.
Oh my God.
Yep.
That poor girl.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But these family members, like any kind of family member, parents, siblings, cousins, whatever, their family just disappeared. They had no idea what happened.
Wow. And there's nothing you can do.
No. Because, I mean, they're adults. Like, and I mean, this brings me back to like, adults have the right to be missing, which is a whole other conversation, but they did. They had the right to be missing. So they were on this journey of letting go of all of their possessions and their families and their friends and, you know, whatever.
But like, did they like wear clothes or
so their eat clothes,
food and drink water?
They did, yeah. But they're so.
Are these like earthly possessions? Like, how far does it go?
Anything that you have that's just like a want and not a need.
Okay.
So you need like clothes and you need like food and water, but you don't need your phone. You technically
need clothes.
You know what
I
mean?
I guess where do they end up drawing the line?
Well, they definitely drew the line above clothes.
Okay.
You needed clothes to be in the cult. Okay. Anyway, the clothes part actually comes back later because they kind of had a uniform. Anyway, T and Doe didn't give them a lot of formal instruction. The group was very nomadic at this time and also living in kind of social chaos. For a while, there were several hundred followers traveling to these various campsites around the country, thinking their leaders were going to teach them a way off of Earth. It was kind of like the blind leading the blind, because they didn't have a deep understanding of what they were getting into. They would have meetings twice a day, and most of those meetings were spent tuning in to the next level, quote-unquote. So Tien Do gave each of these members tuning forks that was tuned to like a note A, if you even know what that means. Do you know what a tuning fork is?
I feel like movies will play on, like, this must be where it's from. You know, where they're trying to, like, contact whatever.
Like ghosts?
No. Or, you know, ghosts or aliens or whatever. Like, people who've gone nuts using tuning forks to contact whatever.
Oh, well, anyway, tuning forks are an actual, like, musical instrument. I mean, it's not like you don't play a tuning fork in a band, but, like, you hit a tuning, it's like a piece of metal that you hit against something and it plays you the same note every single time. So you're able to like tune to that note. Anyway, it's a musical thing. But they gave them these tuning forks that they would need to tune their minds to that frequency. So they would hit the tuning fork that would like give them like a hum, and then they would put it on their forehead and they were tuning into the frequency of the next level.
I feel like this might be really interesting to do while high.
This whole cult would be interesting to experience high, although I might actually have a psychotic break and I think I would hate that, so never mind.
So they're like just hitting the forks and then just straight to the forehead.
Yeah, and then they're humming along with it. Mm. Yeah, that's literally it.
How long?
Twice a day, I don't know. Long time.
Fuck.
It was their whole job. They had no other possessions.
What do you do all day? You just
get tuned to the next level. I don't know. So they would also spend a lot of time looking out at the heavens to make sure that there wasn't like a UFO coming for them. So they would like just physically sit and look at the sky for a long time. And even through the night, they would have hour-long shifts to have someone to continually look at the sky.
You never know when they're going to come.
That's true. I mean, you're not wrong.
They might leave you.
Right. They were also living on donations at that point. They had to knock on doors and ask for money and spread the message and potentially do weird jobs to get money. In December of 1975, after 3 months of being in the group, Robert, remember him, he's undercover, had split up from David and they agreed to meet back up in Montana. Robert had to be home for Christmas, so his time was up. He had a fairly easy time being undercover because you weren't supposed to be forming any human-level relationships, so all he had to do was keep his mouth shut and go through the motions. And that's what he did. He had decided to write a series of academic papers, beginning with Psychology Today. Since they were the only people to be behind the scenes in this cult, Psychology Today made them the cover story.
Wow.
Isn't that really cool? What they concluded was this group was really unique. The two leaders didn't assert their authority nearly as much as a typical cult leader would, or what you would expect. They said there was no evidence of manipulation, coercion, or brainwashing, and everything about it was about free choice. But it would still be 20 years before the incident, and they only spent 3 months with the group. And they hadn't really grasped the severity of the situation at the time. Like, these two guys come in at the very beginning of the cult, and this was like when things weren't as severe as they get later on. So they're like, no evidence of brainwashing, coercion, manipulation. Like, it's just all free will. Everybody's here happy.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is a interesting thing that free will is a core tenet of the cult.
Yeah, well, okay, so I will say this is a very interesting cult. Like, truly, the members who are there the whole time, like, to the very end, like, there were people that left and whatever, but the people who stayed were happy. Like, kind of.
That's what they would say, right?
Well, okay, so there were definitely things that, like, were somewhat uncomfortable, but for the most part, the people who were there to the very end wholeheartedly believed in the message and the work they were doing, and they were very pleased with their experience and, like, would do it again.
Wow, like a Yelp review. I mean, I feel like I want that, you know, right? In
that's,
a sense.
And that's why cults like this, or like, it's so easy to fall into a cult, because if you're having a bad day or a bad time and you're like looking for an easy answer and someone gives you those answers and everyone around you is so happy, you could fall into a cult.
Yeah, I mean.
People do.
Sounds like a good time. You know?
All right, we're starting back up Heaven's Gate. Right. No, I'm joking.
I mean, I don't know what happens later on. So let me preface it with that. I'm here now experiencing with you.
But there's definitely something later on that you're not going to like.
Probably not. But it just doesn't seem like anything that a typical cult would have that would be, you know, manipulative, predatory, and usually sexual in some nature. Like, that doesn't seem to be happening, at least yet.
No, it doesn't happen.
That's shocking to me.
I know, me too. Anyway, so this article was posted on Psychology Today, and the media went crazy with the story. They had tagged this group as a UFO cult and called them all frauds. When the news broke, it really spooked Tian Do. Most of the news wasn't very serious, it was mostly making fun of them, but there were connections made between them and Charles Manson, like the Manson family, and it was said that these people were going to commit suicide, and there were rumors of cattle mutilation, so things were kind of spiraling. But Tian Do felt like the press coming after them or shooting them down was kind of like their demonstration of dying and being resurrected, like the two witnesses in Revelation. They said the media had killed them, and it was a metaphoric martyrdom and resurrection. And the meeting started to become poorly attended, and they lost about 50% of their following. After that, they went into seclusion with the remaining members of the group, and they told them that the remaining members had basically made the first cut, because whoever left was not fit to be in the next level anyway. From there, Tian Do said they felt like it was time to start an intensive classroom training program. So in July of 1976, Tian Do started recording their lessons for the class. They were told ascending to the next level would be the most difficult thing a person could embark on, and it wasn't likely that they would all make it. And they were in the classroom 24 hours a day. Everything that happened to them was to see how they would respond. So their whole life was a test to see if they were worthy enough. They were striving to be perfect. In 1976, Tian Do wrote a guidebook that they gave out to all the members. And inside, they had behavioral guidelines and everything they thought that was important. If you didn't want to follow it to a T, you weren't welcome. The behavioral guide said things like, can you follow instructions without adding your own interpretation? Can you give out instructions as you receive them, or do they change according to your programming? And there were very strict guidelines for everything, down to how much pancake batter was poured, how many pancakes each person got, how they poured their syrup. They also used what they called a check partner system. And your check partner would make sure that you were following the rules at all hours of the day. And they gave you a person that you would least likely be paired with. So it would just could be any rando in the group. And because, I mean, there were like married couples that came into the cult, and you would think like, oh, they're each other's check partners. No, no, they were split up. You got a random check partner, and they were always on you about following the rules. And if you didn't follow the rules, you could be kicked out. So everyone was constantly on edge, essentially. Some people didn't like the rigidity of the rules because, like I said earlier, many of them were hippies and they didn't like to be told what to do. And as more people left the group, the energy only grew because then only the people who really wanted to be there were left. The deepest part of the indoctrination came when members were convinced that they were not human beings. They were actually these beings from the next level that were living inside a human shell that they called vehicles. In one of Doe's teachings, he said they called their bodies vehicles because they weren't related to it. It was like clothes that they were wearing. They also had other terms, like the house was craft, like a spacecraft. The kitchen was the neutral lab. The laundry room was the fiber lab. The bedroom was the rest chamber, and so on. And the vehicle's sex organs were plumbing. Sex wasn't talked about much, except for the fact that they had to avoid it. In thought and in action. They had their own language, that way the old words wouldn't trigger any human recognition or memories. They were also given new names. You had to separate yourself from the humans. They basically became a bunch of monks and nuns. They were celibate and living exclusively to get to heaven or the next level. And like I said, they were given new names. So they got their names by taking their new family name, which was Odie. So if you were in the group and your name was Alex, your name would become Alex Odie. And they would take out all the vowels from your name, and it would be three consonants followed by Odie. So A-L-X, Odie, would be your name.
Dumb.
I'm going to say it. Dumb.
Dumb. Okay, I might not join just because of that.
That's it?
Okay, you're going to call me Alex Odie?
They sure would. Stefodi?
They have their, yeah.
I would be Stefodi. I mean, it wasn't always like your person name turned into, you know, your new vehicle name. Sometimes it was like Chakotay and their name was Erica. Like sometimes it was just, you know, random. But yeah, like I was just giving you an example. You would be Alex Odie. But like,
what if your name was Obi?
Obi Odie?
Yeah.
That'd be kind of fun. Anyway, they were always six letters. So Sawyer became Swayodi. That's what it was.
And they have their own language?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, kind of. Like, they have different words for, you know, everything. So, Odie is a diminutive. So, it means a little member. They were little members of the Kingdom of Heaven. When they made it to the next level and became adults, they would drop the Y and the family name would become Ode or Odd. And they began wearing uniforms. The women and men would all have short haircuts that looked the same. Women wouldn't wear makeup, and they had just a very unisex look. They wore slacks, sneakers, long-sleeve button-up shirts, buttoned all the way to the top, and that's what every single person wore, with their short haircut. They broke down the individual to make them into an entirely new person. If you wanted to overcome your vehicle, you had to lose your identity. And the members didn't see this as oppressive. They liked it. They felt like they were overcoming their humanness. And having that kind of discipline and knowing that you were all struggling through it together created a sense of family, binding people to each other and the group. Kind of like a massive trauma bond, you know?
Yeah.
And they thought that they were doing it for a greater good. But T and Doe had become paranoid that they were being tracked by ex-members, ex-family members, and during the late 70s, they were constantly on the move, moving from campground to campground. Doe told them, "Unfortunately, it's the individuals these vehicles cared for that are actually the greatest threat to us."
Wait, say that again?
It's the individuals these vehicles cared for that are actually the greatest threat to us. Because their whole mission, essentially, was to shed their humanness, shed their vehicle, okay? So if you continued to be in contact with your family or your friends, you were not shedding your humanness. So they posed, the family members posed the greatest threat to the vehicles because that brings in your human.
Okay.
Are you following?
I'm barely. I'm so barely following, but I am.
Okay. Well, good. In 1978, they finally moved into houses, I believe in San Antonio, Texas. A member had inherited some money, between $300,000 to $500,000, and they began renting houses in upscale suburban neighborhoods. And their neighbors had no idea that their new neighbors were cult members, because even though they would have 10 to 15 people living in these houses, they would have designated members who were allowed outside. So not everyone was allowed outside. So the neighbors only ever saw the same people. So it seemed like it was like a family of four. But in fact, it was 15 cult members who never left the house.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's going to be so wild to find out.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh God, like Leslie, Dave, George, and Maddie.
Alex Odie? All...
Yeah.
Weird name.
Madodi?
Rabodi?
They're so cute. They all wanted to rhyme.
Right.
Fun.
So that was their new neighborhood situation.
Yeah, it's not like they're throwing ragers.
Nope, they definitely weren't. They were very quiet neighbors, at the very least. Some members' family members got the FBI involved, and there was a file made, but they ultimately decided that there was nothing they could do since they were all consenting adults who wanted to be there. And they weren't doing anything illegal.
This is so weird. I mean, nothing?
Nothing.
On these people?
No.
And honestly, a few of them come out, they mind their business.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the neighbor you want.
I guess, in a way.
You know what I mean?
But even though the FBI made a file and like checked up on them a little bit, they weren't even really worried at that point about the government checking up on them. They were more so worried that the family members would intervene because, again, it's the most dangerous thing for a vehicle. And family members were terrified because this was around the time of Jim Jones and their mass suicide, like Jonestown. So they began thinking the worst. And, you know, they weren't wrong to think that. Meanwhile, Bonnie Nettles, aka T, wrote a letter to her daughter once a month. The entire time. They even talked occasionally on the phone. She never talked about the group, and the group didn't know that she was in contact with her daughter. She wanted to know only about what her daughter was doing. So T, the leader of the group, quite literally broke her only rule. Well, not her only rule. There were many, many rules, but one of the biggest one.
Interesting. So I feel like this is one of the rules that is tracking for a cult.
Yes. Yeah, the isolation.
The hypocrisy of the leadership.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, nobody can have sex.
Except me.
Except for me.
Yeah, I get to have sex with everyone.
Right. Or I can't, you know, only me can do whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. All the other things we're not tracking, except for maybe celibacy, mm-hmm. but this makes more sense.
Yes, for sure. It was also around that time that T had been diagnosed with cancer. She had cancer in her eye and had her eye removed and she had a prosthetic put in. And she never mentioned it and, you know, it was just what it was. But then she went to the doctor again a little while later and she was told that the cancer was in her liver and she had a very short time to live. And there wasn't anything they could do for her. And it was only 2 or 3 weeks after that that T passed away. And that was in June of 1985. Doe's response to T's passing was deep heartbreak and grief, to the point where he questioned whether he should continue the class. And in October of 1985, following the death of T, Doe allowed members to travel home to visit their families. Frank Lyford and his former girlfriend Erica Ernst were both visiting Calgary since their parents lived there, so they agreed to travel together as Czech partners. So the understanding was that that was all they were. Even though they had been boyfriend-girlfriend for multiple years, they were only Czech partners.
Cool.
Sick. When they stopped for a layover, they were sitting on a bench together, and Frank got this overwhelming feeling that he wanted to hug Erica. And he told her that he asked Doe if they could hug. And he said they could. So they did. And that was the first time that he had touched his girlfriend in 10 years. A hug on a bench at an airport.
Must have been pretty magical.
I mean, yeah. He said that if she told him she wanted to leave the group and do anything else, he would have done it right then and there. He would have left with her, but that didn't happen. Most of these members' families had no idea if their loved ones were dead or alive since they hadn't heard from them in like 10 years. And then they just appeared. Only one person remained with their families after these trips. The rest came back to the group.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who was the one person?
I don't have their name, but isn't that crazy? Only one person.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, I thought that would have been, oh, I hugged her on the bench. You know, we rekindled and we never...
I wish. I wish that's how that went, but it's not. Both of them went back.
Yeah. I mean, this is the story I wanted to believe.
I know. But as far as their teachings went, T's death was very human, which went against their whole belief system. It was a bit of cognitive dissonance, which is when a person holds two or more contradictory beliefs at the same time. The followers were told that T didn't die of cancer. Her vehicle broke down. It looked, that's actually a funny sentence, but that's what
hilarious.
They said. It looked to humans as if she died of cancer, but in fact, her next level consciousness burnt up her human body. It was a test for Doe and for the class, but they came out stronger. Their beliefs. Wow. Yeah.
This is really bending over backwards mm-hmm. with the logic.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Their beliefs went from a bodily transformation to a spiritual transformation, because now that T's body was still on Earth and she was dead, they couldn't say that your body left. You know what I mean? So they're like, okay, now it's not a bodily transformation. It's just spiritual.
Well, technically, they could say whatever they want. You know, I'm sure there's a way they could have done it.
Well, right, but they had to just justify this unexpected death of their leader. And it's crazy because the tragedy of Heaven's Gate, the suicide of all those people, were a direct result of the unexpected death of one of their co-founders.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, even though their entire time they had been saying, we're going to be taken on a spaceship and go to heaven, they weren't necessarily saying, we're all going to kill ourselves. Like, they believed they were physically going to heaven. Or to another, okay. to the next level. So now they kind of had to shift that a little bit. And that's how that came into play.
Okay. Wow.
It's just crazy how that is like what really did it.
Shit just happens, man.
Word.
She just do be fucking fire.
Did you just insights. Hit a bowl or something?
Dude, I feel like I'm high listening to this episode. Your vehicle broke down.
Yeah.
My vehicle's breaking down.
Mm-hmm. Your next level consciousness burnt up your body.
Engine light on in my vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Check engine.
Check engine, bitch.
Check it.
While she was alive, T was called the older member, and Doe deferred to her. He said his connection to the next level went through T. And after her death, Doe still looked at her as guiding him, but now it was just from outer space. And Doe publicly declared himself Jesus returned to Earth, and T was the one known as God the Father. So now we're getting much cultier, it feels like.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, Doe's Jesus. I mean, like, this is, I'm like, okay, now it's a cult. Cult.
I mean, it was a cult before, but it's getting cultier. Yeah, it's getting cultier. After her death, the teachings became much more biblical, and they moved away from T's new age ideas and more to Doe's thinking, which, I mean, made sense. He was trying to become a minister in his younger years, and now it's like, yeah, of course his teachings are more biblical. And Doe became even more obsessed with control after T's death. He asked his followers what they would do with $100 if they could get themselves anything. And they couldn't really handle that question because they had just spent multiple years of their life on the process of letting everything go. They had no possessions, they had no wants, nothing. But the right answer was a wedding band. They needed to devote themselves to God. And so Doe held this marriage ceremony, this like massive marriage ceremony for all of his students. And, you know, from there, they would be going to the next level, closer to God. The group really believed they were training for this trip to outer space. And they were dedicated to being a crew that worked as a whole. They looked to Star Trek as a resource. They were only allowed to watch a few approved TV programs, and Star Trek was one of them. And Doe told them that the Borg was a good model. He wanted them all to be cogs in the wheel for the benefit of the overall collective. So I'm certainly not a Trekkie. I don't think you are either.
Nope.
I didn't know what the Borg was, but from my very basic description of the Borg, it's like To me, it looked like a spaceship with like a bunch of aliens inside, but all of the aliens were like, they talked about like the Borg as like they were all one person, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And it almost gave like AI type feel and like hive mind.
Oh yeah, like bees.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so that's the Borg in Star Trek. And Doe was like, we want to be that. Like, the next level will be there. And it was really creepy because the Borg had this collective consciousness and there were absolutely no individuals. And he told them that was a good depiction of the next level. And a couple of the members were like, that's really creepy. I don't like that.
And so they left. But then there was still people left.
Yeah. They were aiming to be hive mind and completely genderless. Even the men's voices couldn't be too deep. They all had to have the same voice, the same hair, the same clothes, the same thoughts, like everything. And in 1993, 18 years after joining, Frank Lyford finally left the group. And it was actually because Doe had criticized his low voice one morning. He was humiliated and sick of not having an identity. So he was just like, they were all sitting together as a group and it was the morning time. So his voice was a little bit raspier than it usually would be. And Doe said something and he was like, that's it. Like, that was the straw.
Whoa.
Isn't that crazy?
That's insane.
Yeah.
It was just a slight critique.
Yeah.
It was just one too many.
Yep. And a couple days after he arrived in Calgary, Erica called him on the phone and she was weeping, pleading with him to come back. He told her he thought it would be good for her to spend some time outside the group to get some perspective, but he didn't know if she even wanted to say anything about that because, of course, her Czech partner was on the line with her, and then they hung up the phone. And that was the last time that he ever spoke to Erica.
Oh, it's so hard.
Yeah. In Heaven's Gate, you weren't a person. So leaving, you had nothing to go back to. It was a very deep kind of indoctrination. Physically leaving the cult didn't get it out of your head. These people lived in a very strict and depersonalized way. They cut people off from their family and friends. They had their Czech partners, so they had no privacy. They changed their names. They changed their clothing. They changed their diet. They created a different, obedient identity. Stephen Hassan, who is a cult exit counselor, and he is like a cult expert, did a couple of sessions with former Heaven's Gate members, but in general, in his practice, when he does interventions with people, he shows them the ASH conformity study. And I thought this was so interesting. So it's six people sitting in a line at a table, and they're shown a picture with multiple lines on it. There was a line all the way to the left of the page, like one line, and then three lines on the right side of the page. And they would have to pick out which of the lines on the right side matched the length of the one on the left.
Okay.
Okay. So they would have to go one by one and give their answer. And now the experiment comes in because five of the six men knew what was going on, but the sixth man didn't know. So the first few times they would give the correct answer, and then slowly they would all start giving the wrong answer. And then the sixth man, who didn't know that they were deliberately giving the wrong answer, would start to also give the wrong answer to follow the crowd.
Okay.
And this experiment has been done for decades, and 2/3 of everyone who does this experiment starts to give the wrong answer with the group.
Interesting. It's like some tribal DNA that's just kind of locked into who you are.
People just want to fit in. Like, that's just in us as humans, is we want to be a part of a group. And
yeah.
You do what you have to do to conform, essentially.
Yeah, I feel like that's just a survival thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you weren't part of the group
10,000
years ago, you were just fucked.
Yeah, that makes sense. Something in your, like, lizard brain that's just like, must say the wrong answer. The line
is long, yes.
His point in showing this was, we all want to think that we're independent and would never agree, but social science says we're programmed to fit into groups and we're going to start adapting to the people around us in order to fit in. And that was for random people who participated in this experiment. But the members of Heaven's Gate were so isolated and so self-contained, and there was fear that if you didn't fit in, you might miss the boat and not get another chance. It was like you were gambling with your eternity. And they would also use shame as a motivator. Like I mentioned earlier, sex was a big no-no. Doe said it was the most powerful drug that they needed to avoid. If they had a nocturnal emission, or a wet dream, there were these washcloths in the bathroom that you would use to go clean yourself up, and then you would go back to sleep. But people would know if you used these washcloths, so it was a bit of shame and, like, gross. And then that turned into a sign-out sheet. If you had a nocturnal emission, you would have to physically mark it down on a sheet that everyone saw. And there was a lot of shame and guilt, and it was a very defeating feeling, which was enough to keep everyone in check. Dick Jocelyn, who was one of the members who had been recruited in LA in 1975, he had become one of Doe's helpers after T's death. And he was a very core member of the group. Like, he was one of the members who would, like, go up on stage and, like, you know, speak the good word, essentially. But Doe was gay, and Dick Jocelyn was gay. And after a while, Doe told him that he had to take away his helper status because his vehicle had become attracted to Dick's vehicle. So it's not like we're going to have a scandalous, like, leader, like, affair. It's, I mean, well, we don't necessarily want that, but... He was that disciplined that he was like, absolutely not. My vehicle has become attracted to your vehicle. Like, beep, boop, bop, you know?
Beep, boop, bop. I mean, wouldn't it have been, like, still, I mean, it's not great, but still nothing terrible has happened yet. So I get to say,
well,
that have I missed something?
No, but my next sentence might make you feel uncomfortable.
Okay, well, let me say this before that happens.
Okay.
It's like, if there's a gay plot line here, you know,
we always love a gay plot line.
You know, this is kind of like forbidden law. I mean, come on, what's right? Harder?
But okay,
10 years, 20 years, you're in a cult. You're like, no, okay, can't do anything.
Please.
And then this one guy, special guy, comes out of nowhere.
No, please, you're so sexy.
Right? Like, the whole. Could you imagine the whole cult dissolves just because one man's ass is too hot?
It would only be hot if they were all consenting adults, because usually,
right. Right.
Usually the cult sex thing is like, hey, I'm going to take advantage of all of you. And that's,
I mean,
gross.
Yes, of course.
But I know what you're saying. We love a forbidden
but
love.
Do you know what
plotline.
I mean? Yeah. Like, could you imagine, what's his name?
Dick.
Dick. That's another hilarious detail. They're both gay and his name's Dick. Come on. If Dick was just so hot that it dissolved the entire cult.
Well, he was. He was an actor from LA. He was like a hot guy.
Right.
But so that's why Doe was like, I'm attracted to you. And my vehicle says vroom.
Yeah.
You know?
My vehicle's in sixth gear.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, I'm going to move on to my next sentence that maybe is going to take back
okay,
here.
Now okay. Gonna, here we go.
So one day Doe called a meeting and told the group that he had had a nocturnal emission. And because of that, he was looking into having himself castrated.
Okay. But this is him.
Right.
Himself.
Okay,
so now this is going to be everyone else has to get castrated.
Okay, so he asked if anyone had any reservations about also having the same procedure done. And a lot of them, most of them, didn't. So Doe was greatly influenced by some of the more extreme members of the group who fed him ideas, which wasn't unusual for groups like this. And the castrations apparently weren't his idea. They were Sorority's idea, who was one of the more extreme members. He was a real go-getter, Sorority. Anything he needed to do, he would, like, run to do it. The members knew that he was kind of a lot. But when the castration idea came about, they were almost competitive with Sorority to get it done before him because they felt like they were proving themselves to the next level. They were proving their devotion. So Doe set up a sterile room and put a sign above it that said Mexico. And he said that...
What?
Okay, so he said that if the authorities ever questioned them, they could say that they had gone to Mexico to get it done. And they wouldn't be lying. One of the women members, who was a former nurse, would be performing the castrations. And then Doe asked who would go first. And they did a coin toss, which Sorority won. So he got to choose who went first. And who do you think he chose?
Himself.
He chose himself because right. He loves that. So the procedure started and Sorority's testicle sac, I'm sorry, was cut open. And Sawyer, who was a former member, said he nearly fainted. But just after that, it was clear that something was very wrong and Sorority was not doing well. And that was when Doe said to stop and he had gone too far and he let this happen and they needed to take him to the police. They told him, no way. They didn't want him to go to the hospital since that would be seen as something crazy that had happened, but they also didn't want to take Doe to the police. So Sawyer and Lavoti and Genodi said that they would take care of it. Like, what am I going to say?
I can't do
what am I going to say?
Yeah.
They called a priest and asked if they had any experience with someone who wanted to be castrated. And this priest was like, what the hell are you talking about? And so they did end up taking Sarodi to the hospital where he stayed overnight. And Sawyer and Genodi took his testicles and threw them off the pier because they didn't want any evidence.
Could you imagine you're just kayaking down the river?
Oh,
like,
no.
Like downstream from this?
This was like the middle of the night, like testicle drop.
It's not like they Wait. Disappear.
Right, no, for sure. That's just a really crazy thing to say and think about.
Just balls are in the river.
Yeah. No, probably the ocean, because I think they were in California at the time.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, it's still a wild thought.
It is a wild thought. And after that, Doe said that he would stop the castrations. Could you imagine if you're the one fucking guy who got castrated? And then your leader's like, never mind.
No. No, but what Sarodi did was sick, but also not.
Never mind, guys.
Yeah, this is enough.
So he said they weren't going to do the castrations until they found a doctor who was willing to do it for them. So 7 to 9, somewhere in there, men were castrated, including Doe. Although the rest of them weren't interested in the procedure and they were allowed to choose not to do it. But somewhere around 9 men got it done. One man.
It's kind of hilarious that castration was seen as like a macho thing or like a good thing, mm-hmm. you know?
I mean, it wasn't necessarily macho. It was more devotion.
Well, it was done in a competitive way.
Well, yeah, that's the funniest part is that it's like so human to be that competitive, you know?
I'm going to get my balls chopped off first.
I'm going to get my balls chopped off first.
Tyler Stott. Tarodi.
Sarodi, eat my dust, bro.
I can't.
I know.
I just can't with everything going on here. It's funny, but I know it's going to happen, so it's not, you know?
Right. Yeah. Obviously, it's tragic, but it's also just bizarre. One man, Wayne Cook, left the cult because of the castrations. So there was at least one person who said, okay, this is quite enough.
Yeah, but this is a reasonable last straw, is the castration.
That's true. Not the deep voice necessarily. I mean, that I understand it's like, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. That made sense. But this one is like, yeah. If someone was like, yeah, we're all going to be castrated, I'd be like, okay, I'm out now. I was down for the haircut and the androgynous look, but actually I'm done now.
Yeah.
I draw the line at castration.
Yeah.
But so his wife, Suzanne, did follow him. And they were the married couple who like left their 9-year-old or whatever. But their daughter said that it was clear they were on the brink of rejoining the cult at any moment. And actually, over the next few years, they rejoined and left 3 times. But ultimately, they ended up staying.
They ended up staying in the cult?
Yes. So they left for the castrations. And then over the next few years, they rejoined and left a couple times. But they ultimately stayed in the cult.
Wow.
People were free to come and go. I mean, kind of. Like, if you wanted to leave, you could, but also if you messed up, you were asked to leave. Like, if Doe didn't think you were worthy of going to the next level, they said leave, you know? Starting in 1991, the group started to try and reach out to new members because the group had shrunk so much. They were down to only a few dozen. They were also starting to believe that they were nearing the end times. This was a time where a lot of end-of-the-world fears crept into people's minds because it was the turn of the century and a lot of religious groups began popping up saying that the year 2000 would be the end of the world. They started a satellite television series called Beyond Human and paid for 14 hours of airtime, and then they got an ad in USA Today which cost them $30,000. Which is crazy. And they put a P.O. box in the ad and they started getting letters from people. And so they started responding with these people who wanted to talk to them. And they sent VHS tapes and lessons to them to whoever wanted it. And they reconnected with ex-members through that. And they got a bunch of new members, which was when they went back on the road to start recruiting again. And when they did get new members, they were more widely met with rejection, because now they're back out in the open and like the media is talking about it and people are, you know, online. They were essentially getting cyber bullied. Like, people were not nice to Heaven's Gate, which, I mean, it's a cult, so I understand. People were questioning them because it was very weird. And people said most of their teachings can be found in the Bible, so what made them so special? They used the internet as well to spread the messages, and they had created a website, and Doe would also post on forums. In the group, it made sense to talk about aliens and the next level, but on the internet, it sounded like a bunch of crazy bullshit, and people said that. And then members began to feel like their attempts to reach out had failed, and that was their sign to give up on the planet. So this was like another, you know, nail in the coffin for these members, because they're like, okay, we're giving up.
They're giving up by leaving or giving up by...
So their departure would be very soon. And by their departure, I mean their mass suicide.
Jesus.
Yeah. They called it a graduation.
That's so creepy.
Yeah. And they never talked about their departure as suicide. It was always like their graduation, their exit, their departure. And people had compared Doe to Jim Jones. And he actually acknowledged that, like on their TV program or whatever. And there's audio recordings of him saying, "You're going to be the next Jim Jones. How are you going to get out? We don't know. Some vehicles may go back. Some vehicles may not go back." So he's not saying like, yeah, we're all going to commit suicide. He's like, some people might stay. Some people might go. I don't know. Whatever happens, happens. So Doe started to preach that the world had become rotten, and they started to believe the U.S. government was out to get people who believed different things. And this was the time of Waco, and they used that as an example. And he started to look at what the government did to Waco and was like, this is going to happen to us. And at first, he thought that was a bad thing, but then he started to look at it as a good thing. He told his group that they could just buy guns as well to then be seen as a threat. That way, that would trigger their demise. But then they decided that that didn't sound like such a good idea. They're like, actually, never mind. Let's immediately backpedal. Because then some of them would die, and some of them could end up maimed and just stay on Earth in their vehicles. So they're like, you know what? Let's be in control of the situation.
This is such a weird way of getting to the logical position.
I know. They had moved to San Clemente, California around this time in 1994. And they had a meeting in the top floor of a warehouse where they always had their meetings, where Doe told them he wanted to have a meeting with each individual about if they had any reservations about using suicide as an exit. They would take a strong barbiturate, which would put their vehicles to sleep, which was the gentlest way he could think of. There were some tears shed at the idea, but most of the members ultimately said they didn't have any reservations. They weren't going to do this tomorrow, so they did have time to consider the idea, and most of them knew something like this would be coming. Some of the members had been in the group for 20 years at that point, and this is their graduation. So they were pretty much all like, yeah. After that meeting, five members eventually left a few months later in September of 1994, including Sawyer. But he didn't leave because of the suicides or because that was like on the table.
Wait, no. I thought he left because of the voice thing.
That was not Sawyer. That was, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name. John? No.
Someone else.
Yeah, it wasn't Sawyer. I have his name later on in my notes. But anyway, Sawyer left a few months after suicide was put on the table, but not because of the suicide. He had been struggling with the whole celibacy thing, and he had been feeling really guilty about secretly masturbating. And he said that he was two different people. He was Suwodi and someone else who gave into desire. Doe told him he could get Suwodi through this since he hadn't been negatively affecting anyone else in the group. But ultimately, Sawyer couldn't stop and told Doe that he had to leave. So he was given a plane ticket and $600 and he left. Like, right before they all committed suicide.
Wow. So he was the last one to see the end stages of it.
Yeah, but he wasn't even leaving because of the end stages of it. He was just like, I'm having a hard time with desire.
That and saved his life.
Therefore, I can't graduate, kind of thing.
I can't think of a weirder reason for somebody to live.
Yeah. So November of 1996, the Hale-Bopp comet was making its closest pass to Earth within 122 million miles of Earth. It would be the brightest comet that we have seen or humans had seen since 1577. So it was a big deal. In late 1996, the group began to orient itself toward departure, and they really bought into the conspiracy that in early 1997, the government was hiding the existence of a flying saucer that was trailing the Hale-Bopp comet. Art Bell was a conspiracist who had a radio show, and the group would tune into his program, and they said that there was a large object trailing the Hale-Bopp comet. And Art Bell received a call from a woman named Courtney Brown, who was a part of the Farsight Institute, and they claimed that there was a very large flying saucer with Hale-Bopp. And it was about four times the size of Earth. Heaven's Gate believed the spaceships that they would be boarding to get to the next level were really, really big. And the other thing was they had been looking for a sign to end things for a long time, and this was kind of their sign. They believed it was T coming to get them, so they went to the store and they bought a really expensive telescope. But when they used it, they couldn't see any spaceships with Hale-Bopp, so they brought it back to the store and told them that it didn't work. They didn't come to the conclusion there's no spaceship. They came to the conclusion the telescope is broken.
That has to be the most hilarious customer service interaction
yeah.
of that century.
Yes, absolutely. But they decided that whether there was a quote-unquote companion with Hale-Bopp, it was irrelevant because Hale-Bopp itself was the spaceship that they had been waiting for. They had officially chosen their exit time because Hale-Bopp would be the closest to Earth in March of that year, which also coincided with Easter. In December of 1996, they had a Christmas party. They greeted a member who came back to them. They did a talent show. They sang tunes. Nothing pointed to the fact that this group was about to commit a mass suicide. They all headed to Gold Beach, Oregon, since that was where Doe and T first had their revelation. And the weeks leading up to the suicide was like one big vacation. They went to SeaWorld. They went to Mexico, San Diego Wild Animal Park, and the Stratosphere Hotel in Las Vegas, where they gambled. Like, they were having the time of their lives. The build-up to the end started at the end of 1996, which was the last time that they updated their website. But they were concerned the government might try to take it down, so they've sent a physical floppy disk all around the world with copies of the materials. And actually, heavensgate.com is still up, and it is literally untouched. It's never been changed. I can read it to you right now. If you want, or no, you
I wanna,
can.
I
want to
look it up. Who's keeping this up?
I don't know. It's never been touched. It's like literally from the moment Hale-Bopp comet was like around and they updated it like the last time. That was the last time it was touched. Go ahead and read it.
I mean, it's so long.
You don't have to read the whole thing, but it starts with like a red alert. It looks really old.
Yeah. No, this has Star Trek vibes for sure. Red alert. Hale-Bopp brings closure to Heaven's Gate. Whether Hale-Bopp has a companion, quote-unquote, or not is irrelevant from our perspective. However, its arrival is joyously very significant to us at Heaven's Gate. The joy is that our older member in the evolutionary level above human, the Kingdom of Heaven, has made it clear to us that Hale-Bopp's approach is the marker we've been waiting for. Wow, okay. Yeah, I mean, this message just kind of sounds like a public service announcement, like, this is the bus coming.
Yeah.
You know, this is the vibe that it has.
Mm-hmm. That was what they were going for. So.
Wow.
Anyway, that website is still up. They also created a lot of recordings leading up to the event. They were trying to get people's attention because they thought the more information out there would cause more people to follow them. They sent VHS tapes to former members and asked their information to be distributed after they were all gone. They planned this out really well. March 20th, 1997, exit interviews were recorded of all the members. At the time, many of the members had been in the group for over 20 years, and it was clear that they all completely adopted the mindset of their leader, and they were excited. They had a sign-out sheet that they each signed right before they, like, exited, if you will, and on their sheet, there was a box for their, like, time of return. And in that box, each of them wrote a little note, like, bye, or never, or they would put a question mark. And one of them wrote, hasta la vista, baby. Like, they were hype.
Wow. They were happy up until the point that they committed suicide.
That's a really dark thought. That brings us to March 22nd, 1997, which is the exit. The night before, they all had a dinner of turkey pot pie, and they all ordered the same drink and the same dessert. March 26th, 3 days after the exit, Rio D'Angelo, or Neody, he was a former member, had left the group under 2 weeks before the exit. He had left the group under 2 weeks before everyone ended their lives.
Wow.
And he was the one who called in their mass suicide to San Diego, California authorities. He said he left because he had a vision that he had to write about the group. And after talking to Doe about it, Doe agreed. And it was probably part of the higher plan. So he left. Isn't that crazy?
So random.
Yeah. Not long after that, Rio got a packet of instructions from Doe and the others telling him to come to the house to make a recording of what he saw. At that time, the group had been living in a multi-million dollar mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, about 20 miles north of San Diego. And so Rio went into the house after the exit and filmed 39 bodies that he found. And it was reported initially that they were all male, but that was because they all looked pretty genderless and they all had short hair. But it was 21 women and 18 men, ranging in ages from 26 to 72 years old. The bodies were all found in different rooms of the house. They were all laying in a bed with their hands at their sides and a purple sheet over them. They were all dressed in black slacks with black Nike shoes, and most of them wore a wedding band on their left hand, and most of them had $5.75 in their pocket. That had to do with a Mark Twain story, because he said $5.75 was the cost to ride a comet to heaven. And they all wore armbands that read Heaven's Gate Away Team, which is a Star Trek reference. They appeared to carry out their exit in three groups, because they all hadn't been dead for the same amount of time. When they were found, some of them had been dead for 12 hours, while others had been dead for 2 or 3 days. The second group helped the first group do this, and the third group helped the second, until they were down to only two people who were found not covered with a sheet. And they were found with plastic bags over their heads.
Ugh.
The cause of death of everyone was asphyxiation from plastic bags, but they had also all taken phenobarbital and had alcohol as well. So it was poison and asphyxiation. And I actually saw an article. I mean, I had a lot of sources for this episode, but one of the sources that I read said that two of the members hadn't actually died. And they, like, were the ones that, like, carried out all of the other, like, they helped everyone. And then they essentially, like, were alive. But every other source said that, like, all of them were dead. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's something that could be a possibility, I guess.
To even think about this is so dark.
Yeah, it's really dark. So Marshall Applewhite wasn't the last to die. He was in the second group. He was found alone in the master bedroom in the king-size bed. One of the dead had been identified as the brother of actress Nichelle Nichols, who acted in Star Trek as Lieutenant Uhura, I believe is how you pronounce it. But anyway, literally in the actress's brother, which is crazy. The public's response to Heaven's Gate was to treat it as a joke and say say that these people were stupid, brainwashed fools. They joked about it on talk shows. I believe SNL did a skit about it with Will Ferrell. And I mean, they were the butt of the joke. And it was like 39 people were dead. It was crazy. The former members of the group, who had not been a part of this, had nothing but good things to say about them. And many of them expressed their wishes to be with them. Sawyer was one of those members. And even today, he still believes in the teachings of Tien Do and hopes that someday he can grow enough to pass through the Heaven's Gate and make it to the next level.
He's still in the pursuit.
Yeah. But he was one of those members that did an interview to try to clear Heaven's Gate's name. That's hard to say. Which really didn't help people's view of it, but they tried. Some of the former members who went on TV shows and did interviews later also conducted their own exit interviews and took their own lives in attempt to join their classmates and Tien Do. Chuck Humphrey and Wayne Cook, whose wife had been in the mass suicide, were both living together at the time, and they were the ones who tried to follow their classmates to the next level. However, one of them survived their attempt. Chuck Humphrey had reflexively pulled the plastic bag off of himself, and the drugs hadn't killed him. but he was then successful in February of 1998, which is just awful. In 1998, there was also a Heaven's Gate reunion for the remaining ex-members, which was really cathartic for everyone. But in attendance was Terry Nettles, which was T's daughter. And she read them some excerpts from letters that her mother had written her throughout the years. And that changed things for people, because here T and Doe were saying that they had to give up all of their earthly possessions and let go of their families. And she was regularly writing to her daughter and signing it, "Love Always, Mom." In one of the letters, she even wrote, "Be good, strive for goodness, and by all means conform to society so you will have peace of mind." Which was nothing like what she was telling the group. When Terry looked back at those letters, she realized that her mother wanted out of the group. And the members who were at the reunion were not just shocked, but they were also pissed. They weren't angry at Terry, but they spent their lives dedicated to this group, and the leader didn't believe what she was saying. But they didn't know that, and after her death, they worshipped her, and 39 people took their lives because of their teachings. I mean, it may not have gotten there if T was still alive and it wasn't just Doe, but I mean, we'll never know. And it really does seem like she wanted out.
I wish we could have interviewed her.
Right. I mean, it's just a shame that she
doesn't make any sense.
Died of cancer. I know.
Also, it's not her fault that that 39 people killed themselves. It's definitely Doe.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, so she was, you know, one of the founders. Obviously, she came up with the whole idea that they were going to leave the earth and go to heaven and, you know, be aliens and whatever. So it was definitely weird and sounded that way at the very beginning anyway, so maybe she would have done the exact same thing. But also, I mean, she did die early on, and then Doe took it over, and he was just like, you know, saying she's speaking to me from outer space, but like, that's, you know, not real. So yeah, it was Doe. I don't know. It's a tough one. It's also really weird because like all of these people wanted to do it and did it because they...
Yeah,
they,
but then the other people were quote unquote helping them. This is such like a, if you were to actually bring this to court, like let's say two people did survive and they literally helped kill everyone.
Yeah.
What?
No, they would be for sure.
Right. That's locked murder. Up.
Like for sure.
But it's so strange.
I don't actually know that two people did survive. I don't think they,
I'm just saying for the sake of argument.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, you're not wrong. Helping people commit suicide is not like a legal thing to do. So, right?
I don't know. I think like euthanasia is legal in some countries.
Yeah, not here though.
No.
Anyway, it's just an interesting one because it really seems... I mean, in their exit interviews, because they did them like literally the day before, they are very happy. They're very excited. They're like, they know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, yes, they've been brainwashed and whatever for years. So there's that. But it's weird. It's an interesting one.
Did you watch any of them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's chilling.
Yeah. There's a whole documentary. There's a 4-part documentary on HBO or Max, whatever. But yeah, there's a lot of recordings from Heaven's Gate and like T and Doe and the members and whatever. So if you want to see them, they're there. When ex-members left the group and tried to navigate their lives, they didn't really know who they were. And Frank Lyford, who was the guy about the... He left because his voice was too deep. Okay. That guy. We forgot his name. He felt that in a really big way. But he's finally at a point now where he feels like he's free and he, you know, wants to travel and be a person and have fun in his life. And he got himself a van to travel the country in, which makes me really happy.
Yeah.
Frank said he feels like Sawyer is stuck. He feels like Sawyer stopped growing and is a staunch representation of T and Doe, and he's stuck in the past. Sawyer doesn't feel guilt. He just feels like he failed a test that he could have passed. He lives somewhere in Vermont. And he did take back up all his musical instruments that he had to give up during his time in the group. So at least that's positive. I'm glad he's happy with his instruments. But he, at the very same time, still believes in the teachings of T and Doe and, you know, wishes he was there, which is really interesting. So there are two lessons, I guess.
So there's two lessons. Okay. What are the lessons?
To not be judgmental and to be careful. That's at least what they said at the end of the documentary. So People,
I don't know if that's what I'm taking away from this.
Yeah. So people look for easy answers, but it's important to know that one person doesn't have all the answers. I think what they were saying was like, it's a lot easier to fall into a cult than you think, and be careful, kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, that's where Heaven's Gate ends, as far as I know. It's a really interesting one to me.
It's so unique.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just, it doesn't have all of the elements of a typical cult, and everyone who was there really wanted to be there.
Right. I was just thinking that.
And people actually could leave whenever they wanted.
Yeah, they could. Yeah, they weren't doing anything illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, typically these cults were doing something that was really illegal, that like the FBI or whatever major governmental body needed to like take them down, because, you know, whether it was like a sexual predator, or they were hoarding a million guns, or, you know, like, they were things that usually these cults were doing that were illegal and like bad, and many of the members were like scared. But this one was different. They weren't doing anything illegal. They weren't worried about the government, really, until the very end, when Doe got like paranoid. But like, yeah, they all were happy. They all wanted to be there. It's weird. But it's also like they were talking about aliens and going to the next level, and their bodies were clothes. I don't know. It's all very hard to believe, but I mean, clearly a lot of people believed it. 39 people believed it enough to end their lives.
I just don't think I'll ever be able to wrap my head around this one.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, I don't think that's the conclusion I'm coming to, is that we're going to understand Heaven's Gate by any means. But it is just one to look at and say, wow, that is something that happened.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Be careful.
I guess. I guess. But anyway, that's really all I have to say about that. We just spent so long talking about this. Is like probably the longest episode we've done in a very long time, if not the longest one we've ever done. So that's fun. Anyway, what's your good thing?
My good thing is that I'm going to get to see my cousins that are coming in from out of state.
Hell yeah.
For a Huntapalooza, as we call it. And,
we love that.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see them.
Yay.
Bop around and play. They love any and all chaos and mischief, so I'm excited to be like the cool, I'm not their uncle, I'm their cousin, but like the cool cousin.
You also love mischief and chaos.
Yes. And can't get enough of it.
Fun. So that's so perfect for you.
Very cool.
Very
what
good.
Is your good thing?
This weekend, I am going to be visiting my family back in New York. It's the only time basically throughout however long that my whole family is going to be able to be in the same space, like my sisters and my parents and grandparents, whatever. So yeah, I'm going home for the weekend, and I'm going to squeeze my little dog's heads. I cannot freaking wait to squeeze their little beans. Ooh, I love them so much.
Yep.
And yeah, maybe I'll float in a pool if it's warm enough.
Get to see Crumb.
Oh, I love her.
Put Crumb on the Instagram story for the people.
And I will. Yeah, it'll be a close friends exclusive. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to head over to Patreon and hear a bunch of bonus content, or vote on stories you want to hear, head over there at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about eventually, because I'm behind on it, on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival that you would like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listener's episode, please send it to us at notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is not today podcast, and a Twitter that is not today podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.